You're listening to a Monster Kid podcast.
Hi, and welcome to A Dingo Ate My Movie, a podcast that features classic Ozploitation and other slightly left of centre and overlooked Australian films from the 70s, 80s and beyond. I'm your host Pete, and today I'm joined by Tab from Test Pattern to talk about Gillian Armstrong's quirky musical Starstruck from 1982. Hey, good morning, Tab. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. It's great to have you back again for the third time?
Yeah, third time.
Wow, that's awesome. That's very good. I'm really enjoying having people back. It's great.
Yeah, I'm so glad to be here, and this movie was so much fun. So
I'm really glad you enjoyed it. I was really nervous about this film because it's a little bit different to most of the films I talk about on this podcast, and I guess it's quite different to most of the films you talk about.
That's true, but a secret about me is I love musicals. So.
Oh, that's good. That's why I thought you'd be a good match for this.
Yeah.
All right, so today, of course, we're going to talk about Starstruck from 1982. The movie stars Joe Kennedy as Jackie Mullins, Ross O'Donovan as Angus, also Ned Lander, Margot Lee, Pat Everson, Max Cullen, and John O'May. So the synopsis is that Jackie Mullins, who's played by Joe Kennedy, lives and works at the Harbourview Hotel with her family, including her cousin Angus, and dreams of one day becoming a star. 14-year-old Angus, played by Ross O'Donovan, is her de facto manager, and together they go to almost any length to achieve her dream. That's pretty much the synopsis. It's a pretty straightforward movie.
It is, but it's so creative, and I watched it with my friend Micah, who loves music and especially loves kind of like 80s new wave, and she was like, I've never seen anything like this, and how come we didn't get this kind of music in America, you know? So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was definitely made at that era, like in the new wave era. If you look at Joe Kennedy in this movie and her character, you get those real Toya Wilcox vibes, you know. I don't know if you know who Toya Wilcox is.
I don't, but I'm thinking of people like Cyndi Lauper and,
yeah,
you
exactly
know.
The same. Yeah, yeah, the whole new wave sort of look, right?
Right.
And it's great. The songs are fantastic and really, really a film of its time.
Yeah, very much so. And just super cute and fun. Like, this is the kind of movie that if I had seen it when I was a little girl, it would have been right up there with the other movies I loved from this era, like Pretty in Pink or Satisfaction, which is about a bunch of girls who want to start a rock band and, you know, things like that.
Yeah, it's really good. I love it because it's light. It's not really a heavy movie. It's very, you know, in some ways there's a lot of cliches, but it's really fun and it has lots of great songs in it, which is really good.
Yeah, and I think it saves it from being cliche because the characters are so unique. There's nobody like Jackie in movies that I saw in this era, and there's nobody really like Angus either. So it's really cool. I think the unique characters save it from being like a cliche teen movie, you know?
I think so too. And there's a really great chemistry between those two.
Yes, yeah.
So interesting to find out, like when I was doing some background, you know, getting background information, that they actually auditioned together and was quite impressive, and that's how pretty much they got the part. But, great movie. For me, I mean, it's just like a super fun, joyful movie. It's a really good movie if you just really want to watch something and feel good. It's one of those great movies. Can be cliched. It's very typical, you know, let's put on a show sort of thing. It's a little bit daggy at times, but it's kind of, do you know what daggy is? Kind of like
it drops or, you know, lags in the middle. Yeah.
No, Daggy. I mean, how do I explain Daggy? It's an Australian term. So if you're a dag, you're someone that's like a bit of a, what would you be? It's one of those, I can't explain it. It's like if you're a dag, you're someone like, you know, a dad joke, like, you know what, someone that would tell a dad joke.
Okay.
So yeah. It's like a dag is someone that kind of like that, you know, a little like that, bit stupid, you know, sort
but in a
lovable kind
cheesy
of way.
Cheesy kind of.
Yeah, a bit cheesy. Yeah. So, you know, it's like that. But there's great songs, there's a couple of laughs, but it's actually got a little bit of heart as well. I actually like the fact that there's a bit of heart in this movie as well. Some really good characters, you know, we just mentioned Angus, and why do I keep forgetting her name as well?
Jackie.
We just mentioned yeah. Angus and Jackie. But I really love Pat Everson, who plays Nana. She's cool.
Yeah.
She's so kind of lovable gets that whole thing, that whole Nana part down really well.
The part I love with her is when she runs up to Jackie and gives her bag when they're at the show. And then she comes back and she's like, that's my bag on TV. Yes. So cute.
It is so cute, yeah. And she's so into it. She's so supportive, mm-hmm. but she's great. She's really good in this movie.
Yeah, she is.
Really enjoy.
She really brings a lot of the heart to it, I think, because Pearl is kind of cold and not very motherly or sympathetic to what the kids are wanting to do. So,
did you have any other thoughts initially when you watched the movie?
I loved all the color and the costumes and just the fact that right off the bat, Jackie is so unique. She's got the bone in her hair when they come out of the hairdressers, and then they go to the club and it's very like new wave club. And it's got kind of a hyper-real feeling because everybody's doing the same dance and stuff. And I love that. And I especially love that about Australian cinema. One of my favorite movies as a kid was Strictly Ballroom. And there's a very sort of hyper-real fantasy element to Strictly Ballroom that I felt like was in this movie too. So I had a ball watching it.
You can kind of see that in this movie. I've only seen bits of Strictly Ballroom. I probably should watch it. So many people have told me to watch it. But anyway, and you can see that. You can see bits of Priscilla in this.
Yes,
And it's definitely got that whole fit, that sort of Australian musical sort of feel and mm-hmm. comedy feel to it, which is really good. Really enjoyed it. It's so much fun. Production-wise, I guess there's like the original idea of the movie came to the screenwriter, Stephen McLean. He was raised in the same sort of pub environment as Jackie and Angus was. So it's kind of written, I guess, from his experience growing up in that environment. And, of course, it was directed by Gillian Armstrong, who had come just off My Brilliant Career. I'm not sure if you've seen that movie before.
I haven't, but I think it's very well regarded, right? It's kind of an indie movie that's been talked about quite a bit.
And it's a very classical Australian period piece. Very serious. So it was really interesting that this movie came out after she'd made My Brilliant Career. And if you look at I think it's the US trailer, it starts off with like, you know, from the director of My Brilliant Career sort of thing. And it's quite interesting. And that caused a bit of an issue because some critics loved it because of the change of direction and because she'd done something so different. And of course, on the other side of the fence, a lot of critics found it just too different from My Brilliant Career. So they couldn't really get into it. They were disappointed. No, there wasn't, from what I've learned, there wasn't any really negative reviews, but there are a lot of reviews where they were just like, you know, meh.
Yeah, I feel like when people do that, they don't really get the movie. Like, I feel like this movie is reaching out to the people that are like Jackie, who are like on kind of the outskirts of the mainstream and willing to be themselves. And that's the kind of people that this movie would definitely appeal to.
Yeah, absolutely would. And it is really quite a different movie from My Brilliant Career. It's great. Production designer Brian Thompson. So he was also known for his work in Rocky Horror Picture Show.
I read that.
The follow-up, Shock Treatment as well. And you can really see it in this movie.
Yeah, I think one of the neon signs was supposed to be used in Shock Treatment, right?
Oh, really?
That's what I had read. And that they, like, he didn't end up using it in Shock Treatment, so he carried it over into this movie. But I think the production design is brilliant. I love her room with all, like, the cutouts all over the walls. Because that's something that I always wanted to do as a teenager, and I wasn't allowed to, so.
And she sleeps in a blow-up pool.
Yeah, I know.
So yeah, it's quite weird, but it's great. That club at the start, that lizard lounge scene, mm-hmm. is just great, and it's very reminiscent of all those sort of movies as well.
Right, I love Angus's sheets too. We were trying to figure out who is on his sheets. It's like an,
I think it's
like an
Elvis, is it?
Is it really? It was almost like an Andy Warhol, like different color print of somebody. We weren't sure who it was. Micah thought it might be Iggy Pop.
Could be, yeah. The interior of the pub of the hotel, the Harbourview Hotel, which is a beautiful hotel, which still stands down in the rocks in Sydney, around the rocks area in Sydney, was the interior of the hotel was all shot on a set rather than in the pub, because the train line on the Harbour Bridge pretty much goes across. And I think there's reference to it in the movie. They just couldn't film in there all the time because of the noise of trains all the time.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So they shot it in a set, and it's unfortunate because people go to the pub expecting it to be like the movie, and the bar is pretty much the same, or was pretty much the same, like that nice big curved bar.
Mm-hmm.
But the big mural of the Harbour Bridge isn't on the wall. It was never on the wall. So that was just built for the movie, which is a bummer because it looks great.
It does. It does. I think they did such a good job with all of the production and the costumes. Like I loved all of her little weird outfits, even the tightrope with the wings, like the little iridescent, almost like fish scales. And then she's got the little shorts made out of the same thing.
The costume design's fantastic in this, especially, like you said, especially for her. It's so eclectic and strange, and it's really good. The finale takes place in the opera house, mm-hmm. right? But it wasn't shot there.
I wondered about that.
Yeah, so they couldn't shoot in the theater. So they allowed them to shoot on the front steps, you know, when they're disguised and they're going in and they're doing those funny dance steps on the stairs. So that's the stairs going up to the opera house. And then inside the opera house, when they've got the road cases and they're moving around the backstage area, so that's in the opera house.
Mm-hmm.
The only part that's not is the actual auditorium they're in, where all the songs take place, which is actually at a place called the Seymour Centre, which is like, no, I wouldn't say down the road from the Opera House, but it's not far. It's just basically the other end of Sydney, the southern end of Sydney.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah. So they couldn't get permission to shoot in the auditorium, so they took it there, and it's just quite interesting they did all that. And the other scene in there is the scenes at the end where Angus has met up with the ice cream girl.
Right.
They're having a big pash on the
That's right. They just
on
like
the stairs.
Down the stairs.
Yeah. Yeah, so those stairs are actually in the opera house as well. So they could film everywhere except inside. Any other bits you sort of picked up, or any other production bits you?
Just that they never released this on CD, but it was only available on what looks like tape and record, and they never like released this on CD. I was kind of surprised to find it on Amazon to rent, because this is the kind of movie that you might have to watch on YouTube, over here at least, because it's just, you know, a lot of times these movies fall through the cracks as far as being available.
Yeah, it's criminally unavailable, really, especially in Australia, right? I had to buy the DVD off eBay.
Oh, wow. And, okay.
Yeah, and it's by Blue Underground.
Oh, yeah.
So it's actually not a bad DVD. The transfer is quite okay in most places. It's got a commentary, which is okay. It's got an extra disc that's got a lot of extras on it as well, which is quite cool. So it's good, but it's really, really would love a nice Blu-ray release with a nice rescan and better sound and things like that. It would be fantastic. Now, I don't know who has the rights to it anymore, because I don't think it's I think it's out of print as far as I know, which is a pity. Umbrella used to have the rights here, so I don't know whether they still do. I'll just have to bug them about that one.
I can't believe that this isn't more known, because I could totally see people loving this as much as something like Times Square is loved, or I like Satisfaction, but that one is like nowhere. You can't find that one. So maybe these kind of movies have kind of just fallen out of fashion.
Yeah, they probably have a little bit, and which is more the pity, right? Because they're really fun movies to watch.
Yeah, I loved this, and we were always excited to see a song come on, because they were all so different, very 80s. Like, I actually really loved Angus's song. I thought that was great.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's a great song. Yeah. I've got something to say about that later. It's really good.
Yeah.
The film, I think, was budgeted at $1.8 million and ended up costing $2.2 million.
Oh,
and it was shot between August and September in 1981. So the costs blew out mainly because when they first wrote the script, the first script only had two songs in it. The movie at the end of the day had 10 songs in the movie.
Oh, wow.
So the cost blew out because it takes longer to film songs and musical scenes. So there was that. And also apparently there was so many films being made at the time because we're in the middle of this era where the government was funding or, you know, giving a lot of tax breaks for these movies, that it was really hard for them to get crew. So it was costing them more money to do that. So it ended up costing them, I think it was $2.2 million, I think you said in the commentary.
And I think I read the movie did pretty well, actually, but not quite well enough to cover the actual full cost of the film.
Yeah, they did. It did quite well. The only issue was that because they initially aimed it at younger viewers, you know, that 12 to 18-year-old, when they went to the movies, they weren't paying full price.
Mm-hmm.
So effectively, they weren't getting as much as they would have liked for the movie. There wasn't a massive adult sort of viewing for it.
Yeah, and I also, you had sent me a site, it's basically a fan site that has a ton of history about the film. It's called starstruck1982.weebly.com. The person that put that site together talked about how it was censored as far as being advertised before a certain time because of the rating. And so basically they couldn't market it to the audience they were looking for.
Yeah, they wanted to put it on, I think on Countdown or something like that, which was a weekly music show in Australia. And because the movie was PG, a show that was rated G on TV couldn't show a clip from a movie that was PG or, you know, like MA or whatever. So they weren't able to do it. Is that was Australia in the 80s. So weird censorship shit. But yeah, and that site is fantastic. I think her name was Camille Scaisbrook.
I spoke
to her via email because I sort of said to her, I sent her an email and said, hey, I've got this podcast episode coming up. Love your site. It's got so much info. Are you okay if I, you know, use it for a bit of a resource? And she was totally fine with it. And she even gave the upcoming episode a bit of a plug on the front page.
That was so lovely. I was like, oh, that's so nice. And the site is beautifully done. Like, I've seen a lot of fan sites for these movies, and this is probably the best one I've ever seen because it's easy to read. It's clearly well-maintained. Good job.
Yeah, she still adds to it. Yeah, great job. She still adds to it as far as I can see.
Yeah.
And there's so much stuff there. There's stuff like, because this isn't one of these films where you can go to IMDb or Wikipedia and find bucket loads of information.
Right.
It's not a lot of information there. I really wanted to talk about the music.
Yeah, let's do it.
Gillian Armstrong and David Elphick, so the producer and the director, thought that the music was going to be really important in this film. They asked for and received a number of submissions for the film, like apparently boxes of cassettes, right? And there was also strong interest shown from In Excess and Men at Work, who both wanted to be involved with the film. But at the time, they passed over them, right? I think there's one of the documentaries on the DVD, Gillian Armstrong is reflecting and kind of saying, well, we kind of missed that boat, didn't we? Because about a year later, or 6 months later, that's when Men at Work pretty much blew up in the US. And that was kind of like the beginning of the Australian sort of invasion. Inverted commas. I think at the time the film was made, In Excess had released, I think, their second album, which was called Underneath the Colors, which had Stay Young on it, which is a great song. Men at Work had just released Business as Usual, which was a really big success. It was their big album here and then released in the US.
Mm-hmm.
The film, as I think we mentioned or you mentioned before, was made during that whole new wave era. And you can really, really see it in the style of songs if you look at these in the, you know, the songs in this movie, they're very new wave, a lot of them.
Yeah, I thought that was so cool. And I think they start out with Temper Temper is like the first full song. And I was just like, this is amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's a really great song. The band The Swingers feature really prominently in the movie, and they provided four songs to the soundtrack, but Phil Judd, who's in The Swingers, wrote some of the other songs as well. The standout for me of the songs they gave to the movie is One Good Reason. I think that's a great song. That's, I think, in that same sort of, I think it's in that first scene as well, the Lizard Lounge.
Mm-hmm. The one that they actually play?
Yeah, they're playing. That's The Swingers doing that. And I really like that song. So Phil Judd from The Swingers was asked to write 10 songs in 10 days for the film. Right. They only used two. That was Temper Temper. He wrote that. And Tough, which is the pool scene song, which is a great scene as well.
That is a great scene.
The Swingers were formed in New Zealand in 1979, and they're probably best known for their song called Counting the Beat. Catchy little pop tune. It was number one single in Australia and New Zealand. It was also used for ads for quite a long time for Kmart in Australia.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the band broke up pretty much when Starstruck was released in 1982.
Oh, yeah.
So Phil Judd then went on to pursue a solo career and compose music for soundtracks of Australian films like The Big Steal, Death in Brunswick, and Mr. Reliable. So he's done a lot of other sort of work as well.
That's awesome.
The hit song for me, well, for me, and also the hit song from the movie was Body and Soul.
Yep.
Which is the song they do in the pub, which is really catchy, and it's just a fantastic song. I love listening to that song all the time. The song was written by Tim Finn from New Zealand's Split Enz. You know Split Enz at all?
That sounds familiar, but I don't know if I know them for sure.
And it was originally released by Split Enz as She's Got Body, She's Got Soul on their 1979 album Frenzy. I'm
cool.
So it's a couple of years old by the time they got to it, but it's a very catchy song.
It is. I could tell that would be like the standout song. You know, if they were going to play one on the radio, that was going to be it, you know?
Yeah. And that was the one that they wanted to play on Countdown, but they couldn't because it was from the PG film. So I think there was an episode of Countdown where they did like a live mime of it sort of thing.
Oh, okay.
With Joe Kennedy and the guy. So I haven't seen the clip, but I think that's the case. They have there were other bands that were used in the soundtrack. There was Turnaround. So they were a young band from Tasmania who came to Sydney to play the pub circuit in the 80s. They do that song, it's called Turnaround, in the scene at the end of the movie in the opera house. They're that's a band there.
Yep.
And then there's Mental as Anything, I love Mental as Anything. It is a great band name. Who at the time, they'd already had two top 10 hits in Australia, If You Leave Me, Can I Come Too, and Too Many Times. And they went on to become probably one of the most popular bands in Australia through the 80s.
Wow. They
had piles of singles and absolutely loved them. There was a couple of gigs I did in the 80s where bands I was in supported them, and lovely guys, really great pop sort of songs, rocky sort of songs, different. They have this great song that's kind of based around ABBA called Berserk Warriors, which is fantastic. You should check out.
I have to ask, is there like an Australian thing with ABBA? Because there's so many Australian movies that use ABBA.
I know ABBA's massive here. So ABBA, if we're talking about ABBA, I think Australia was the first country that ABBA went to number one.
Really? Okay.
And, yeah, and had a lot of hits in Australia and became like really big in Australia. So I don't know they were as big in the US, right? I know everyone knows their songs, but at the time I'm not sure they were as big.
Yeah, I don't think they were as big. Like, I just remember watching Muriel's Wedding, and there's a whole ABBA subplot with that. And then the same thing with Priscilla. They have a whole ABBA song that, like, they lead up to at the end. So it's like, they must love ABBA.
Yeah, ABBA was really big in Australia. And I think there's that, it's called ABBA the Movie that they made in the late 70s, early 80s, and it's all set in Australia.
It really? Okay, well, that
so,
makes
yeah,
sense.
So, yeah, so they were pretty big on Australia because they were, you know, pretty much the first country that really made them famous.
That's awesome.
There was other songs in the film written by Dennis Natras, and then there's the other song, I Want to Live in a House, was produced by Molly Meldrum. So that's a great song.
Yeah, that was like my favorite, you know, if I had to pick one.
So when Ross O'Donovan went down apparently to Melbourne to record the track, Molly Meldrum requested so many vocal takes of the song that apparently he almost lost his voice.
Oh, my gosh.
So he must have sung it a lot. Molly Meldrum, of course, is in Australia pretty much music royalty. He was a co-creator and the host of the popular music show Countdown, which was pretty much every Sunday night, aired from 1974 to 1987.
Wow.
Was something you watched all the time. It was on the ABC, which is like the public television station or the government television station. He was very instrumental in growing the industry in Australia, and also it's questionable really to what the industry would have been like without him. He sort of broke so many acts. He was really big at breaking acts and bringing acts onto the show that weren't well known. And he was also really big with, like, there's people overseas, like he was one of the first people to have Madonna on, and I think I'm not sure if they're personal friends, but they're apparently quite close, and he's really done a lot for the industry locally.
That's awesome. So it's kind of like Top of the Pops in Britain,
yeah,
and to a lesser extent, the one that was popular here in the 50s that I can't remember now.
The Bandstand?
American Bandstand, yeah.
Yeah, that sort of show. And that was always like the live playing to a recorded backing track
right.
sort of bands. And there were some bands I think played live. there was a lot of things like, you know, a lot of music reviews by Molly and interviews, and he would fly overseas and interview people. Really interesting person. He's getting on a bit in age now, and I think a couple of years ago had a bad accident. He fell off a ladder in his backyard. And saw him on a TV show not long ago, and he's looking, unfortunately, a lot older, but still has the you know, the life inside of him that he used to have then. So he's great, Molly. Really liked him.
That's awesome.
We talked about the soundtrack before. So it was initially released by Mushroom Records. It was released a couple of months prior to the movie opening and reached number 17 on the charts here, which was pretty good. And the cover of the LP, there was a gatefold sleeve. I don't know if you read this on the site. This is where I picked this up on this great site. There's a gatefold sleeve, and then you cut out figures on the sleeve.
I saw that. That's so
and you
awesome.
Glue them into the places on the sleeve, and you have this little pop-up scene inside. It's amazing.
Kind of like bringing the movie to life, because she has a lot of that kind of thing. Like, he makes her that thing where it's like a vision board, basically, of what her look is going to be. And then also her walls kind of look like that, too. And it's like the opening credits. So I thought that was such an ingenious way to market the record. And Mushroom is the label that put out the Dead and Drive-In soundtrack, I believe, as well, right?
That's correct. I think so. I think there's a lot of Mushroom artists on that album, on that soundtrack, correct. Yeah, I was only thinking about that movie the other day. Do you know what? I've got to tell you, I was in the studio last week, so we did some recording before the whole shit fight where Sydney's just come out of like 14 weeks of lockdown.
Oh, yeah.
Or we went in last week to do some mixing, and I was talking to Mark Scully. Mark's the producer/engineer for us. And I was telling him about the podcast, and I was telling him about the movies we did, and I said, oh, we did Dead End Driving. He said, I love that movie. Did you see me in that movie? I was like, what? He said, I was an extra in that movie.
That's crazy.
And I was like, holy shit, I'm going to check that out.
Well, now you have that beautiful Blu-ray to do that with.
Mark's a great guy. He used to be in a band called Rat Cat in Australia, who had a couple of hits, and really lovely guy. He's a really nice guy. The soundtrack album for this movie, you can actually buy on Discogs, but I think the prices for like near mint are around $50-$60. So it's unfortunate because you can't get it on Spotify. It's not on Apple Music. It's like nowhere, absolutely nowhere. The only place I found it was somebody on YouTube has obviously recorded the album and put it on YouTube, and it sounds okay.
Right.
But as a playlist, but it's not the same. I would love to have it. I used to have it on cassette years ago, but not anymore.
The cover is great because it's a great shot of Joe Kennedy with her hair and like the finale look. I love everything about the creative choices about this movie because everything's so artistic and it feels like something that like the characters in the movie would have chosen. Like even the title, the way that it's written and the credits and the font that they chose. I think they did such a great job making it feel really cohesive.
Yeah, the design's fantastic. And it runs through everything. Like you were just saying, it's cohesive, right? So it runs through the artwork, runs through the costuming, the set design, everything. It's fantastic. It's really good.
Yeah, I loved it. It made the experience of watching it like even better because it was like, oh, yeah, it's almost like they made this, you know?
Are we ready to talk about some scenes and some general chat?
Let's do it.
My cousin Angus, he's reading this book, Sex Psychology, and he reckons guitars are like phallic symbols. And guitarists masturbate for a living. So God knows why you need me.
All right. So the first thing I really want to talk about this movie, and I've got this as on my notes, as family ties, right? I got confused maybe. So Angus, right? Is he Jackie's cousin or brother? So in the movie, she calls him cousin, right, quite a bit. But in the commentary and the special features, the production team refer to him as her brother.
I think in the movie, he's
a cousin, right?
Because the guy that comes with her mom is his dad and the grandmother's son. So I assumed her dad is Angus's dad's brother.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, isn't it? Because then there's the whole bit about Angus's father being with Jackie's mother.
Right. And she says he's her brother-in-law.
Yeah, and I think Jackie even makes a point of saying, or is it, or is it Angus saying it's quite odd that they turned that she found him when she was in Queensland on her little holiday sort of thing. It's kind of but then when she walks into the pub with him, she says that he's her brother-in-law.
Yeah, so he would have been her husband's brother, right?
It sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah, so
it's really weird.
Yeah.
But of course, Lou, the guy we're talking about, he has ulterior motives for all this. So the first scene I wanted to talk about was the Lizard Lounge and Temper Temper.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
The song. So I just think as an opening to this movie, it's super strong. Like we have those few scenes leading up to it where Jackie's gone to the hairdresser and they're having that conversation and, you know, Angus is telling her that you just have to think about things and they'll come to you. It's like he wrote The Secret or something.
Yeah, pretty much.
And there's all that sort of happens. And although, you know what's interesting about that? Like I sometimes feel that if you do, not so much wish for something, but if you kind of keep something in your mind that you do want, eventually, in a lot of cases, it does come your way.
Yeah, I think, you do have to work towards it. And that's something he says later. He says, you know, if you dream about something and you work towards it, sometimes it does come true. And so it's the work part that they were missing in the beginning.
Correct. But, because I think just thinking about it just puts you on the track towards it.
Right.
You do what you need to do. So it doesn't just drop in your lap. When they get to the Lizard Lounge and this is shot at Bondi Pavilion, the venue looks great.
Mm-hmm.
They've got all those swingers posters inside. She turns up or he turns up in the kangaroo suit.
Yep.
Which they got from some shop. And I just find this whole scene's fantastic. It's a great introduction to Jackie in regards to the singing. It gives you an idea of what she, you know, looks like, what she wants to do. The music is great. Like you were saying, the kind of, you know, the way everyone's doing the same movements and the band, and we walk in and we've got the swingers playing. Then we have that little interlude where, because it's a talent show, right?
Right.
And we have that other woman doing whatever she's doing.
Yeah, she's doing some sort of like Spanish-inspired dance, I think.
And then we have Jackie who does her thing, and then, you know, they're backed by the band, and eventually the guitar player is like, wow, you know, and
he ditches his girlfriend. Sort of,
yeah, he does ditch his girlfriend. That scene where they're like, where they're at the back in the dressing room or wherever they are after the gig, and his girlfriend comes up and says, "Have you seen Robbie?" And all the guys are like, no. So yeah, it's interesting. I just think it's a really strong introduction to the movie.
I totally agree. I think you get what they're going for with the look right away and the music style as well. So I think it's a perfect way to introduce you to the scene that she's in. The costumes are great and the lighting is so awesome. I want to go to that club.
Yeah.
I think that it's awesome that she comes out in the kangaroo outfit and then sort of reveals her performance outfit. That was really fun.
The next scene that really resonates with me, and I think I called it out before, was the pub and the song in the pub, She's Got Body, She's Got Soul. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is just like, for me, I don't know why that song has struck such a strong chord with me over the years, but I just really love the song. And every time I hear it, I just feel really good. It's sort of like a fun song, and the choreography of all the people in the bar, and there's all these different people in the bar. You've got like the afternoon sort of shift workers coming off their shifts, and you've got so many characters in that pub. You've got the guy who complains about the beer all the time, and I think Pearl says that he spits in his beer to make it go flat or something like
that. I think it's Reg that says that because she's
It's Reg, yeah. That's it. Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, there's so many weird characters and funny characters in that scene, and it's also enjoyable. I just really like that scene. It's great.
Yeah, that song is great, and again, we get more sort of new wave dancing. Like she's dancing with Terry, and they're sort of like going back and forth. And I love that she just throws on like a striped top and she's still got the little like iridescent bloomers from when she was doing the tightrope walk.
That tightrope walk scene's really good too.
Yeah, that's sort of, it's great.
Yeah. I didn't write anything about that, but I really liked that scene. Apparently there was like 95 camera setups for that scene.
Yeah, I can imagine, because they have to kind of get her from all different angles and stuff.
Yeah.
And I do love when she yells at Angus and she's like, you better be down there when I hit the ground, because you caused this and you have to be there when I splatter all over the pavement.
When I splatter all over the ground. Yeah.
What's the name, dear?
Jacqueline Mullins.
And what's the idea behind all this?
He thought if I got noticed, I might start a career.
You're going to have to move that truck in, Mom.
You want to be a professional aerialist?
I want to be a singer.
Then why the tightrope?
Ask him. He thought of it. Look, this is agony. I can't hold on much longer.
Is she going to drop?
Well, not until I've finished this interview, I'm not.
When you decided to pull this stunt, did you realise how much trouble you'd cause?
I'm just trying to splash things up a bit. I'm emotional. I sing because I'm emotional. Perhaps you could trace all this back to a very unhappy childhood.
Hang on, dear, hang on.
Look, I've done me dash, Angus. I want you down there when I splatter. And when they scrape me up, just remember it was all your fault.
But they had a stand-in for her, of course.
Right.
Who had an accident, actually fell.
Oh, no.
And didn't land properly, like the bit where she drops off. She spent, I think it was 2 weeks in hospital with issues with a back and stuff like that. Yeah. Uh-huh. And in the commentary, the guy was saying, every time I watch this, I can't really enjoy this scene because it was so stressful for them. But it is a good scene, though. I do like it. It's kind of fun. And it kind of shows you what ends they'll go to get her discovered.
Right. Angus is very dedicated to getting her noticed, which is really cute.
Yeah, it is. And of course, from the scene in the pub, the Scott Body or Body and Soul scene, we have John O'May's character saying to her, yep, you're going to be on the show, because his character, Terry, has like a show, pretty much like Countdown, right? It's like a weekly music show. Wow, called Wow. and they're trying to get on that show. They want to get on that show and wants her to become famous. So, you know, Angus goes through all this stuff, the tightrope walking, getting on the phone to him through the tightrope walk and getting him to watch the TV.
Right.
And he ends up bailing her out after the tightrope walk because the police take her away. Mm-hmm. I love the bit when she's on the ground after she's, you know, gets rescued from the tightrope. And everyone's cheering and she's jumping around. Then the police take her away, and it's so typical. Everyone starts booing the police. Right. And it's cool. It's cool. And, yeah, so he ends up bailing her out of the police station. And, and then we end up, after that, he goes back to the pub, and that's where we get this scene we're just talking about. He says, yep, you're on the show, be in the studio, whatever. It was in a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And that's the other scene I wanted to talk about. So what happens is we end up with this scene where she goes to this studio performance, and as soon as she arrives, they're starting to try and change her. So she's kind of forced to conform to the request of the TV show that she's appearing on. You know, the band can't play with her. They want to change her clothes and her hair. And this causes a bit of a rift between her and the band and Angus. Mm-hmm. And internally, I really think she's struggling between wanting to be successful, like she's driven by being successful, but she also wants to stay faithful to her roots. So she's really torn, I think, you know. And also she's kind of like, you know, do I become famous at the expense of my friends and the band I'm in and my cousin, or do I, you know, maybe take a risk of not being as successful and be myself? That's what I kind of got out of that. And in the middle of that scene, we get that fucking great song, I Want to Live in a House.
Yes.
Because she has that argument with Angus and she says she doesn't want to live in the pub anymore and she wants to live in a house, and that's where that whole song comes from.
Yep.
Listen, I know you. You're gaga about Terry. Kissy, kissy, throw a leg over him, why don't you? But don't let him talk you into this.
Angus, you need other people in your life. So do I. That's called healthy. Face it.
What are you on about?
I'm saying it's time I made my own decisions, my own friends. I'm sick of living in the pub. I want to live in a house.
Live in a house? And dump me at Heartbreak Hotel.
You do a great impersonation of an adult, but remember you're 14, a minor.
Yeah, a minor part of your plans. That's the type of minor I am. You little shit!
Agnes! You know what you are? You're a dirty rat!
You're the dumb one that didn't desert the sinking ship!
That is such a great song. To me, I was looking at it, and I was like, oh, when I was looking at it again the other night, I was like, you know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of, like, Richard Lester and A Hard Day's Night. There's bits of scenes in A Hard Day's Night. Not exactly the same, but that sort of choreography and, you know, funny choreography and jumping and all this sort of stuff.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm listening to the commentary last night, and the producer who was talking on the commentary is like, oh, this is very reminiscent of Richard Lester and A Hard Day's Night. I'm like, what?
You totally nailed it, man.
So obviously I'm not the only person to jump on that, right? So it's and it's a really good sort of scene, and the song is so great. You had something to say about the song, I think. You wanted to talk about
it? Oh, I just really love the song, and I think it's got very unusual choreography, and I like seeing Angus get a moment. Like, Micah and I were both kind of like, oh, I'm so glad he gets a song, and he does really well, and does a great job with the dancing and stuff. So
it is, it's such a great song, and the way that I love the way it ends with them on the van and then going,
yep.
And that obviously is a nice segue into them leaving the studio,
right?
So then we go back to Jackie, and she's singing this song. It's not even the song she wanted to sing. Mm-hmm. I think they were going to do Temper Temper again.
I know they're practicing on the roof, and they're doing Monkey and Me, which comes back later.
Yeah, maybe it was that one. And she was told to do My Belief in You. Now, I don't even know where that song came from.
I don't know either.
Whether it was one of her songs or whether they just gave it to her. So she's told to sing this song, and she sings this song, and she's made up looking like just like any old sort of, I don't know, TV singer of the 80s, solo singer.
Yeah, Micah said she looked like somebody from the Grand Ole Opry from that time, like the shiny fringe and the big hair. And
yeah, the hair was massive.
Yeah, it was. I think it's a wig, but
it's pretty terrible, and she knows it. You can see when she's singing the song, she's having doubt in herself, and she's having issues looking at which camera to look at. But to me, I think it's great. I love the way she acts in this scene, because I think it shows there's a lot of pathos and this internal struggle that's going on within her while she's performing this song. And at the same time, we've got the band sitting back at the pub taking the piss out of her. And sort of like, you can see this is kind of like the low, you know, every movie kind of has a low point.
Right.
It's kind of like the low point of the movie, and, you know, and she's kind of sold her soul off to try and be famous. And then Of course, this is where we have Jeffrey fucking Rush. Yes, into the movie,
that's right.
Who I'd never realized before. I'd never thought of it before because I hadn't. It's been some years before I watched it again recently. And when I watched it, I was like, that's Jeffrey Rush as the stage manager guy.
Yeah.
And it was his first film, apparently. It was his first thing he did.
That's awesome. You pointed it out to me before I watched it. And then I looked for him and I was like, it is Jeffrey Rush.
He's so young.
He's very young.
Yeah, he's super young. And so she's terrible. And of course, we have the scene where I think who's in the crowd from her family? Is it Pearl and Nana and her dad? Not her dad.
Reg, his name? Maybe?
Uncle Reg, yeah. He's called Uncle Reg, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other guy you mentioned before, was it Rob?
Robbie should be with the band, though. I don't know if Robbie.
No, what was the other guy? There was a fourth guy with them from the pub.
Oh, was it?
Might have been.
Hazza, the guy that complains about his beer.
Might be him, yeah. The guy that threw the guy out through the glass doors,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
Because he was just ashamed to see her on this tightrope or whatever. Anyway. Yeah, they're there. And this is the scene you were talking about where Nana gives her the bag.
Yeah.
She's got the bag.
I thought that was so funny when she's up there dancing with the bag. Like, she looks like they pulled her off the street going to the store and, like, made her get on stage.
It's good. And it's kind of, like I said, it's kind of cute. And she's, it is so and cute. Nana's really into it. And you see her walking along and they're trying to get the show going. And she goes out and walks across right in the front of everything and gives her the bag.
She's like, now you look perfect. And then she's so excited about seeing her bag on TV.
So then we, you know, she's really disappointed in herself. And she gets invited by
Terry.
God, I keep forgetting him. Terry. She gets invited by Terry to go to a party for him. And this is where we have the tough scene, the song Tough.
For 1982, the fact that this character is gay was handled in a really fun way and a way that didn't make it feel like homophobic at all. Like, this pretty out there to have him sitting on a pool floaty with his, I assume, his boyfriend, and then surrounded by a bunch of other guys. And then we later get her talking to Angus about it, and there's nothing homophobic said. It's just like, yeah, he's gay. And I thought, you know, yeah. I thought I was going to end up with him, but I'm not, and he just wants to be my friend. So I thought that was great for 1982.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty progressive, and I thought the song really fitted really well.
It is, it does, and she just has fun. She jumps in the pool and is singing along with all of them.
Gets into it. And she's got that great outfit with, like, a record.
Yeah, the record skirt, right? I was so mad when they made her change out of that, because I was like, she looks amazing.
But really good scene, and like you said, they handled the whole gay piece really well.
Yeah,
and it's really good. Very much that old Busby Berkeley thing,
right,
with the whole,
right, all synchronized swimming.
So all those guys, they're not like dancers. They were apparently like real lifeguards.
They
hired.
They did a great job then, because I never.
They did a great job. Yeah. So it's a really fun scene.
It is.
They go back to the pub and she has that conversation with Angus in the park across the road. And then she goes back into the pub and finds Robbie.
Right.
And then there's another song. Did you get the song on the version?
Yeah, yeah, I did get the song. It's like kind of a slow love song where she's basically like apologizing and saying she wants to be with him.
I only found this out the other day. In some versions of the movie, that song is taken out,
oh, wow,
for whatever reason. And it wasn't taken out by anyone in the production team. So the producer last night was saying that he was going to show somebody the film and he had a VHS and he pulled out the VHS of it and played it. And that scene's not on the VHS at all.
Wow.
Some cuts of the movie have it in it, some don't. So that's why I was interested to ask you if it was in there.
Yeah, it was in mine.
It's not a really strong song.
Yeah, I would say it's probably the weaker of the songs, not counting the one that's supposed to be kind of not fitting for her, where she's singing on stage. Like, that's the point of that song. But yeah, this one is, I think, because all the other ones are so upbeat and so catchy and they've got great dance moves, this one isn't quite there.
Yeah, so that scene for me is you know, the whole thing about, you know, getting them back together again, obviously, after. I don't know if I would have been a bit pissed off if I was him, like, you know, oh, suddenly this guy you're chasing, oh, he turned out to be gay, so I'm back with you now, yeah. Sort of thing. Yeah.
Right, and he seems to really care about her. I mean, he takes off from his girlfriend and when he hears about her getting arrested, doesn't he immediately make his band's van turn around and go find her?
Yeah, they go straight back to the pub.
That's right.
Yeah, you can see where they, you know, have it. Apparently they didn't have great chemistry on set, though.
Oh, okay.
They weren't close. Like, Joe Kennedy and Ross O'Donovan,
mm-hmm.
who played Angus, were very close on set. I mean, you can see that chemistry between Definitely. Them. With her and the Robbie character, there wasn't a lot of chemistry apparently on set. And so you can kind of see that a little bit. He's got a weird chin too, that guy.
I didn't notice
that. Did you
that,
notice that? No. He's got a strange chin. I don't know if it's his chin or his bottom lip or something. It's kind of weird. But, yeah, I shouldn't be making fun of him. I'm not making fun of his appearance. It just poked out to me.
You just noticed it, yeah.
Just noticed it, yeah. So they kind of make up, and we have this whole subplot around the pub's not doing too well. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where Angus is kind of sitting low and he overhears the brewery that's obviously providing the beer for the pub saying, you owe us all this money, and if you don't pay the money, we're just going to take the pub from you or take the lease away.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying that the lease has been with the family for three generations, et cetera, et cetera. So he's like, okay, we really have to do this New Year's Eve thing and we have to win the $25,000. Mm-hmm. Sounds like probably a lot of money in those days.
Oh, yeah, probably so.
To save the pub. So this is where we get one of those cliched, you know, we've got to put on a show to save the whatever.
Yeah, but I love how they do it. I mean, they do the jumpsuits and they sneak in. And that choreographed, like, dance up the stairs of the opera house was such a cute little moment.
It was cool, wasn't it? And I was thinking last night, it would have been quite difficult to learn.
Yeah, absolutely.
They kind of, you know, infiltrate the opera house. And I'm just trying to think, have I missed anything?
No, I mean, the Christmas section, but that...
Oh, yes, Christmas. So they have this scene... So there's a scene at Christmas, and I think it's a cute little scene as well, where they're all together at Christmas. They all know that this could be their last Christmas together at the pub because the pub's not doing well, and Nana's been sick. I think she
choked on her dentures. Well, there's a really weird cut there because that's like the night of the show where Jackie doesn't do well. And then they say, oh, you know, Nana's choked on her dentures. And then, like, they hard cut to her being in bed and Angus putting a Christmas crown on her. And like, that was a week ago. Come downstairs for Christmas.
Yeah, it's like they've cut, like, they've lost a whole
week. Yeah, like, they've lost a whole scene or something and they had to kind of stitch it together.
Or they just wanted to move it on.
Maybe.
And they wanted the scene to be, because obviously it's got to fit into New Year, right?
Right.
So you've got to have Christmas somewhere in there.
Right.
So, yeah, so there's this nice little Christmas scene where they're all sitting around a table and Nana's not really, you know, she's like, oh, everything's passed me by. And I think that scene you talked about as well. And, you know, he gives her the scarf and the
gazing ball, yeah.
And the gazing ball because she says she hears spirits and talks mm-hmm. to spirits and all this sort of stuff. And yeah, it's a nice little thing. And
yeah, that's where he gives Jackie her vision of what she's going to look like for the show too. And they've cut the head off of Pearl's old, it looks like a beauty pageant picture, and put Jackie's head on her.
And eventually she gets that dress from her mother.
Yeah,
right?
She does something to it to make it look like a loofah, though, when she's actually performing. It's like shorter or something.
So, yeah, so they infiltrate the opera house and get into this New Year's Eve show, and the security must be really lax.
Right.
But anyway, they and they eventually get on stage and start to sort of look like they're just setting all the instruments up for the next band and all this sort of thing. And they stay on stage because they're going to play, and they all start playing. And of course, what do? They shut the power off, right?
Right.
So they shut the power off them, and this is the scene. You've got Jeffrey Rush running in and out doing different things, and the bit where he runs on stage, tries to get him off stage, and then hits the floor and tries to crawl away because he doesn't want to be on screen, and all this sort of stuff goes on. And then eventually, for whatever reason, they just decide, oh, I'll let him go. It's all good.
Probably because they look so cool, because they've lowered Jackie on what I think they said is like the New Year's star. So instead of the ball drop, they're going to have the star come down. And she's sitting on it in that really cool dress. And they kind of just are like, okay, let her go.
Let her go. Yeah. And of course, they win the competition, right? It's like
they don't even have judging. They're just like, here's the check. You guys won.
Yeah, it's obviously just like, okay, you're good enough. You won.
Well, the kids are going nuts, to be fair. Like, they love this.
Yeah, there's that whole bit where Angus is like on the microphone saying, everyone's trying to stop us, you know, why do we want Jackie Mellons? And they all start chanting Jackie Mellons. And yeah, so they end up playing, and that's a great scene because it's a great song too.
It is a really catchy song.
and of course they win. You know, not really much else to say. I mean, the Swingers come back on and
play Starstruck,
and play Starstruck, right? Which is typical clothes for a movie like this. And Angus gets chucked out during. Does he get chucked out during Monkey and
Monkey Me? Because that's when he sees the ice cream girl and she's singing along.
He sees the ice cream girl. So the ice cream girl was played by, I think her name's Karen Fairfax. It's Karen, but with an extra A.
Oh.
So I don't know if it's a typo or just the name. She auditioned for the part of Jackie unsuccessfully, so they still gave her her part. I don't know if you could see her as playing the lead, but she auditioned for the lead. Also, it was interesting, I found out that another person that auditioned for the lead was Deborah Conway. Deborah Conway was the lead singer of a band in Australia called Do Re Mi, who had a hit with a song called Man Overboard in 1985. And she also auditioned for the part of Jackie and didn't get it as well. Apparently auditioned really well. But I think they were really struck with the chemistry between Joe Kennedy and Ross O'Donovan.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they went with him. And I think she's so perfect for the movie.
Oh, yeah. Her look is just amazing on its own. But, yeah, I think she brings so much to it in her performance. And they do have great chemistry, so I couldn't imagine anybody else playing this part.
So Angus meets up with the ice cream girl. They make eyes, and next minute they're pashing on the stage.
Yes. Rolling around.
Big pash on the stage, rolling around. So it's a happy ending for him. It's interesting that he's doing that, but he's not backing, so somehow gets back inside for the big ending. And,
yeah.
And the movie basically ends with, I don't know, it sounds like a bomb dropping and going off at the end. Did you hear?
Oh, I don't think I noticed that.
There's that boom, and then it goes into the titles.
Oh, yeah. Maybe credits. I thought it was just the transition to the credits.
Well, I think it is, basically, yeah. But it's good. I love the final scene's great. I just think it's sort of, like I said, it's a great song. It's played really well. There's a lot of, you know, it's very up. Yeah, it's really fun. And, you know, ends the movie. It's a really simple movie, but it's a really fun movie to watch.
Oh, yeah. I you know, I'll reiterate, like, if I had seen this movie when I was around the time of seeing things like Pretty in Pink and Satisfaction when I was a kid, you know, preteen, I would have loved this, and this would have been in my regular rotation for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Any closing thoughts on the movie? Any final thoughts you had?
Just for people in America, this is available to rent on Amazon, and I would highly recommend it. There is a illicit version, or not illicit, but a legal version on YouTube, but it's kind of hard to see what's going on because it's not a great transfer. The one on Amazon is quite a bit better, but I think it's totally worth it. And I would hope that people would check it out. If you like new wave music and 80s movies where people form bands, like this is the movie for you. I highly recommend this.
I think it's a really underrated film.
Absolutely.
It's almost a cult film these days, and really love it. I just think, you know, it's a great movie to throw on if you just want to feel good. It's nothing much more to it. There's a bit of depth to it, but it's just a fun movie to watch.
How did you see this for the first time?
I would have seen this, I wouldn't have gone to the movies. So 82, I was 20, mm-hmm. exactly 20. So I wouldn't have been, I wouldn't have seen it at the movies. I would have probably caught it on VHS.
Cool.
Probably a year or two later, a couple of years later. That would have been my first viewing of it, and I probably watched it quite a, because I know I've seen it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the trouble, I used to own the cassette and play the cassette to death because I just love the sound. The soundtrack's so great.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you can get the soundtrack anywhere, I'm going to start, I'm probably going to go into Discogs and buy one of those albums. But if you could find it, it's never even came out on CD, right? So you can't even get this on CD. So it's really something that I think is being underestimated and under-released and
mm-hmm.
really one of those movies that, you know, it's probably worth looking for and worth finding if you can find it.
I would love to get the record just for, like, the cutout thing, although I don't know if I'd be able to find a version that had everything that came with the record, you
yeah.
know?
Well, you're probably going to pay a fair bit for that.
Yeah, so, probably
yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah. So what's happening in Tess Patton world at the moment?
So we are just wrapping up our Halloween programming. We've done some really fun episodes for Halloween. We did werewolves. We did ghosts. We did Monster Squad and Little Monsters for kind of like a all-out monster fest. And we're wrapping it up with Nickelodeon cartoons that had Halloween episodes. And then we are taking November off. So we won't be releasing any episodes in November, but we are coming back strong in December.
Awesome. That sounds great. Have you been listening to much lately, podcast-wise?
I've been listening to a lot of a true crime podcast called True Crime Obsessed. They have some great chemistry. They've covered a lot of different true crime documentaries. And for their Patreon stuff, they have like equal the catalog that they have on their regular feed in extra Patreon episodes. So that's been really fun to go through. And then, of course, there's a podcast called This Ends at Prom, where they talk about movies geared towards teen girls in like the 90s and 2000s. And it's a very interesting listen. I highly recommend that one as well.
That sounds great. You really love your true crime stuff, right?
I do. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show again. It's been great to have you. It's always good to have everyone come back.
Thank you so much for inviting me for this movie in particular, because I had so much fun with this. This was a joy.
I knew it would be perfect for you. You were the only person I thought of. I thought, I really want to do this movie. And I was thinking of all the people who could do it. And I'm like, oh, it has to be Ted.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. That is such an honor because I love this.
All right. So when we come back, we'll have a chat about what's on next.
And now, preview time. When it comes to entertainment, you can't beat a good film. So let's take a look at what's coming your way.
I'll say three of my favorite Australian movies, and I'm just going to pick them off the top of my head rather than try to get too specific about them, is would probably be Richard Franklin's Road Games, George Miller's first Mad Max, and then there's a third movie that I'm a real, real big fan of called Next of Kin, that stars John Jarrett, and it literally is a horror film quite unlike any other. I talked to John Jarrett about it because that director never did another movie. And I think they were maybe an industrial filmmaker that was able to kind of put a movie together. And I barely kind of remember the story, frankly, to tell you the truth, right? I mean, if it focuses on a young woman and John Jarrett is her boyfriend in it, But the tone I remember is, it has a very, very unique tone. And the closest equivalent to this tone is The Shining. And there's no movie that really feels like The Shining, with the possible exception of this movie, Next of Kin. And it doesn't try to take anything from it. They share no other similarities. But there is this mesmerizing tone of dread that's in the film that I think is truly unique to it. And it's very, very evocative. It maybe falls apart a little bit at the very, very end, but that tone that it carries through is really kind of, it's truly unique to itself. And I think that's a real, real terrific thing.
Next time on A Dingo Ate My Movie, Brandon's back to discuss another film from 1982, the haunting, gothic-like slasher, Next of Kin. Thanks for taking the time to listen to this episode. Thank you to all my guests who give their time to make this podcast possible, and a special thanks to you for listening. Don't forget, you can follow A Dingo Ate My Movie on social media. We're at Dingo Movie on Twitter, Dingo Movie Pod on Facebook and Instagram, and on the web at dingomoviepod.com. If you'd like to support the show, head on over to Patreon and sign up for early episodes, bonus episodes, and other goodies. Check us out at patreon.com/dingomoviepod. And finally, we love feedback, so please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, or drop me a line at pete@dingomoviepod.com. I take feedback very seriously, and it helps me to improve the show for you and all the other listeners. Once again, thanks for listening, stay safe, and I'll see you on the next episode of A Dingo Ate My Movie.
Swim, go on, swim. Move your mouth like a fish, like a fish.